Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. Over the next 1 week or so, we're going to be talking quite a bit about China. This is partly driven by some of the research that Suyash and Manoj have been doing. And also, today's episode is also driven by some recent congressional testimony. I have with me today Suyash and Pranav. And we're here to talk about China's expeditionary capabilities, meaning it's the ability of its armed forces to project power onto the territory of other countries. I want to start with you, Suyash. Even the term expeditionary capability is looked on with great suspicion today. It has colonial overtones and so on. But why does China, this great anti-colonial country, need to have expeditionary capabilities?
So Aditya, we have to roll back a bit into past decade or more to understand why China needs expeditionary capabilities. China's interests overseas are increasing rapidly. China has a huge diaspora outside, and China is investing more and more. Part of its overcapacity, they are investing more and more in other countries through BRI. We are quite aware of that. BRI through an economic implication. Not only China's overseas capacities, infrastructure capacities, but along with that, Chinese diaspora is increasing through BRI because they send their whole team to work there. So in that case, and we have seen that not all countries are stable where BRI investment is happening. There can be hostile countries and there can be an event where there needs to be evacuation. So in such type of events, China requires an expeditionary force to carry out evacuation smoothly. For example, just like what is happening in China right now, coronavirus, and certain countries had forces to evacuate their citizens from there. Similarly, if there is an outbreak or if there is some contingency, in such situations, China needs a force to evacuate their citizens, their diaspora out of those countries, especially the hostile countries, and bring them back to China. That is the first and the most important purpose. That is why China needs an expeditionary force. Also, another most important point is China's UN operations are increasing. Right now, among the P5 members, China contributes most troops to United Nations peacekeeping operations. China is the second most fund contributing member. They contribute around 15% of UN budgets. So its involvement in international affairs, international relations, China is going out since 2000, and its involvement in international relations, international affairs, international security is increasing. And these UN peacekeeping, if you try to analyze how UN peacekeepers operate, they operate in a hostile condition. So also they need support, they need backing. Expeditionary forces kicks in. Third point, China's vital trade routes. It is a very cliched argument, but an important argument that it flows through SLOC and South China Sea.
SLOC is a sea line of communication.
Also, they are looking at alternative mechanisms of diversifying their oil through land. And you need basic protection for this interest. Hypothetically, if there is a war tomorrow, if there is a conflict tomorrow, it will directly impact their oil and energy routes. And for this, they need to protect their overseas interests. And that is the third important reason why they are investing into expeditionary forces. So their rationale would be to protect their sea lanes of communication, to protect their lanes of communication. I don't know the exact term used for that, but lanes of communication on land through which the oil will flow in future. Fourth point, they also have a lot of investment in ports outside. These overseas investments in ports, in seas, not only land. We have already spoken about land. So expeditionary forces, for example, offshore oil platforms. So you need to protect that as well, especially in the hostile regions in the Western Indian Ocean region. And that is why they require expeditionary forces.
Now, just to try and summarize what you said, one is as China's economy has expanded, its interests have also expanded. And so you have overseas investments like BRI. You have, for example, gas pipelines that may be coming up. You have an overseas diaspora. And finally, you have that traditional role of the UN peacekeeping operations.
Yes.
And so basically, this is about protecting Chinese assets, Chinese citizens and continuing the old role of peacekeeping operations. Am I correct?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Now, some of these seem to be very different operations. For example, protecting an overland gas pipeline means sending forces into the territory of another country, possibly over a long period of time. On the other hand, you know, at sea, they're moving through the global commons. It's less intrusive. But what is China doing diplomatically to shape up its expeditionary capabilities?
I can talk about diplomatic and legal mechanisms combined. So there are three ways of doing it, at least three ways in which China has done it. There are many other ways, I'm sure. One is through SCO. So China is
Shanghai
Cooperation Organization. So China is arguing through SCO that they live in a very hostile environment, especially on their western borders. And that is why they need more and more institutional mechanism through SCO. So they try to put their expeditionary forces. They don't call it expeditionary forces per se, but they try to peep their forces through XCO along with different countries. For example, China and Russia into deployment into third country to protect their interest. And China has a lot of stake in the Central Asian countries. So they try to, one way of doing it is institutional, legitimizing and institutionalizing it through SCO. The second way of doing, at least the how China has done is through something called as QCCM, that is Quadrennial Cooperation and Coordination Mechanism. There are four countries involved: Pakistan, Tajikistan, Afghanistan, and China. So they have limited amount of troops, especially in the Wakhan corridor, protecting China's overseas interest. That is the investment that they have done through Belt and Road Forum. A lot of investment is in Pakistan. So for that, they have a limited mechanism of all the four countries' forces operating together in this area. Then the third one is, of course, UN peacekeeping operations, where they are deploying more and more forces, Chinese forces. The covert message here is to get wartime experience, of course, because the Chinese, it is an old saying that China, PLA is infected with peace disease and they don't have wartime experiences. But the overt message here is to protect the interests, that is, of their own interest and other countries' interest in the third country or different territories. So this is how they are using diplomacy and legal framework to justify or rationalize the things that they are doing.
Expeditionary capabilities are really a subset of your broader power projection capabilities. What are the power projection capabilities right now that China has built up? Just give us a quick recap.
So China's power projection capabilities since Xi Jinping's military reforms have increased quite a bit. Actually, it started in 2008-2009, but it has escalated under Xi Jinping. It has fastened under Xi Jinping. So they are investing into aircraft carriers. They are investing into amphibious capabilities. They are investing into frigates, cruisers. They are investing into amphibious capabilities include LPDs and LHDs. They are investing into replenishment and auxiliary ships. Also, this is the hardware part. They are also investing into bases, which they were initially calling civilian ports. Now they are calling military outposts overseas. One classic example was 2017 port in Djibouti. It is also said that Pakistan, Myanmar, and Cambodia are probable candidates. We don't know anything about it yet, but these are the probable candidates for military outposts that China is planning to invest in future.
What you've talked about right now, both China exercising its sea legs and as well as building this civilian, as well as building this port infrastructure. But Pranav, there are also, that's not the only way China could actually develop logistics support, right? There's also civilian ports.
Yeah, the Chinese companies operate about 94 commercial ports across the world, across all regions. So these commercial ports have always been said that, oh, China has such a large number of commercial ports, so China could use them. So there are technically three companies or four companies that actually operate these ports, which are mainly Chinese links. They either are wholly owned by the Chinese or have strong Chinese links. For example, the Hong Kong-based CM port or Chinese merchants port, one owned by the PRC's transport department itself, the Ministry of Transport. They own about 56 ports. And there are other smaller companies like Hong Kong. There's a company called Hutchinson, which operates a small number of ports. So the idea has always been that China could technically use these ports and they have some legal mechanisms through which they could actually call on some of these private companies, especially companies like CM Port and Casco, which have majority holdings in operation and control, right? Such as the mobilization law and some of the laws under the Civil Military Fusion Program.
So just tell us what the mobilization law is.
So the mobilization law is such that during any time of crisis or during any national security issues or any of such problems, Chinese local businesses are called on to give support to the PRC and the Ministry of Defense and the PLA. And these companies will be reimbursed in the form of cash or in the form of kind. But at the same time, they're also going to be rewarded for helping the country stay safe. So these rewards are ambiguous. We don't know what the citizens will be awarded and so on.
But yeah, so obviously it gives the Chinese state legal power to commandeer civilian vessels.
In theory.
And I'm sure, but in practice also, you know, obviously these companies are going to be rewarded in some way or the other with party favor if they cooperate. And you can imagine, it's very hard for any of these companies to seriously say no. They're not going to say no.
Yes, but the studies within the PLA and the National Defense University in China actually show that this model is actually not as viable as it seems. One study in 2017, for example, said that many of these terminals are not suitable for military ships. There's no legal basis for entering these ports because there's only one terminal in operation while the other two terminals are strictly for civilian purposes. There's also the issue of what are adequate defenses for some of these terminals which have been given. Another report from the PLA Navy's paper actually said that it took about 20 days for them to replenish the fuel and the ammunition and so on, even using one of these commercial models. And finally, there's the other problem of the geography. So many of these ports are in democratic countries. Some of these ports are strictly for commercial purposes. They only carry ships and there's no sign at all of them having any military connections. So the PLA officials actually doubt that this would be any useful model, right? So in reality, one of the testimonials says that this capability is not in full development yet, but it shows the sign that they are ascending to have this capability. Unlike the United States, which has legally binding agreements with countries to go and stock logistics, to go and park their ships, and they have full-fledged military bases, right? China does not have that kind of things. China does not have very good allies who can support such military operations other than Djibouti or potential candidates like Cambodia. So Chinese are really, really trying to garner support through this kind of model. But I don't know if it'll be successful. Probably only logistical wise, but supply of ammunition, supply of additional troops. How do you get troops off board and get new troops on board? These are very, very difficult challenges they'll face, especially when they're operating ships that carry aircraft and helicopters and so on.
Absolutely. I think you make a good point. Though, of course, as Suyash pointed out, Gwadar or Cambodia are going to be exceptions to this rule.
Also, I have to add 3 points to what you were saying. You're right, absolutely right. But Chinese are doing something about it. So, for example, in 2008, when they just started the overseas operation, HDR operations in Gulf of Aden, they had 3 to 5 replenishment and auxiliary ships, of which 3 could be deployed anytime at seas. Now they have 18 to 19 of them. So they are increasing the number. The purpose of this ship is to do overseas refueling, replenishment, stock, etc. Second point, the role of PLAN, that is PLA Navy and PLA Air Force, is changing, and it is also reflected through its white papers. So they are saying that we need to develop more overseas capacity, and which is seen, for example, their Y-20 aircraft, which is a weight carrier aircraft, which can carry troops, which can carry tanks, etc. So the number of Y-20 aircrafts are also increasing. Aircraft is also increasing, which can supply. I agree with the point that you need to have agreement for landing that aircraft, but they are developing those aircraft to supply them, supply the troops and whatever ammunition required into the third country. And third point, here comes the role of PLA-JLSF, that is Joint Logistics Supply Force. It is working in tandem with civilian agencies, and the whole purpose, this force was formed in 2016, and the whole purpose of this force is to provide logistics to whosoever required. It can be Air Force, it can be Army, it can be Marine Corps. So Marine Corps is basically expeditionary force, and its size has tripled in past 3 years, from 20,000 to 1 lakh. They are factoring in all these things, and that is how they are developing into a more expeditionary capable force.
All right. So obviously a lot of what you talked about is generally building power projection capabilities, logistics, supporting vessels at sea, refueling and restocking vessels at sea, having an integrated logistics support force. But what is this Marine Corps? What does it do specifically? What is its force structure?
Okay. We shouldn't get confused based on the name. Chinese Marine Corps is expeditionary in nature. It is China's expeditionary force. It was formed in 2016 or 2017. When it was formed, it was only 20,000. Now it is 1 lakh. It is deployed in Djibouti. A part of it is deployed in Djibouti, and a remaining part of it is divided in three fleets. China has three sea fleets. Its role is equivalent to an expeditionary force to protect China's overseas interest and to carry out expeditionary operations. So that is how it plays itself.
So in that sense, China's expeditionary force is already in place, and it's just, even if it's still at nascent stage, at a nascent stage. But now I want to ask you both, what should India do about this? Firstly, should India care? And if it should, what should it do about it?
India should have an expeditionary force. I think once a peninsular command comes in, we will have more clarity on how it will be. I am sure right now we have Para-SF, which is working along with Navy as an expeditionary force. If required, it co-ops with Navy as an expeditionary force. But we don't have, with my limited understanding on Indian forces, I think we don't have an expeditionary force right now. So you are asking whether India should worry about China's expeditionary forces. I think up to an extent they should, because at least the defined role of China's expeditionary force is to protect their interest overseas. When it comes about the evacuation part, the diaspora evacuation, we don't have to worry about that. But when it comes about protecting the sea lanes of communication, that means Chinese appearances in Indian Ocean region, that will also be used by Chinese to get familiar and acquainted with Indian Ocean region. And that is where a worry part comes in for India. So increasing Chinese presence, increasing naval bases in Indian Ocean region is something that India needs to worry about.
Obviously, anything the Chinese do, whether it's out of benign intentions or not so benign intentions, India will be worried. Basic nature of security dilemma. I feel that India should have a model where it pursues a legal, the most legal form of acquiring bases and trying to build its own expeditionary capability, which is not through the use of commercial ports, but rather negotiate deals with other countries to establish one terminal. First, have a capability so that India could operate within its own region. What could India do to have a sufficient expeditionary force within its own country? And then think about, where are its interests in other regions of the world? Where are its major diasporal interests? Where are the major choke points where you would need the use of force for securing your national interest in the end? India could counter that in such a way. It wouldn't be an exact counter to it, but it would be sort of like being on par with China.
Yeah, you both have talked quite a bit about power projection in general. Yes, obviously China's power projection is going to be a big worry for India. And India is, I think, going to follow a fairly agreement-based approach to expanding its own sea legs in the region. I don't think India is going to go in for very informal agreements. That's not how India generally does business. To my mind, China's expeditionary capabilities do have some very direct impacts on India, because what China considers a friendly government, for example, may be a hostile government to India, and vice versa. So a Chinese power projection on land somewhere may directly impinge on India's interests. And so India, A, may have an interest in blocking that Chinese expeditionary force, or in fact using its own expeditionary forces or out-of-area operations to reverse what the Chinese have done. So I think that China's expeditionary capability, especially those in the Indian Ocean region, are going to be very interesting. And this is a space to watch, definitely. I'm glad we've got on it right away. And I'm sure we're going to end up doing more episodes on it. Thank you so much, Suyash and Pranav. And thank you for joining us on All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, Don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.